this is Building Bridges.
So rich, so poor, why it's so hard to end poverty in America. That's the title of Peter Edelman's new book. Professor Edelman teaches at Georgetown University Law Center and was a member of President Clinton's administration until he resigned in protest of Clinton's signing 16 years ago the Welfare Reform and Reconstruction Act.
With us as well is Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver, Executive Director of the National Council of Negro Women, who's been described as a change agent living on the intersection of race and gender, fighting for justice every step of the way. And to complete our panel, Frances Fox Piven, Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York.
Frances has authored Challenging Authority, How Ordinary People Change America.
Nice to talk to you.
Capital has been able at various periods with tremendous upheaval from the populace to provide social welfare programs. Are we at a point of crisis in capitalism where we will no longer be able to extract the reforms that will deal with the most fundamental levels of poverty? Peter?
We can. We know a lot about what to do. The problem right now is our politics, and the question is, can we make our politics better? It's a pretty discouraging time right now about all of these issues.
Frances?
There's nothing inevitable about policy constellation that dominates the country now. But the way we would have to look for change is to push the 1% and push them hard, push them in ways that overrode their incredible propaganda capacity. The question is really not are there things that could be done, but a politics question, a power question. Can we imagine that American working and poor people could mobilize the leverage and the tumult that would force new policies?
Avis, do you want to weigh in?
What we need here is political will. Political will has to be driven from the bottom up. Ultimately, the choices now are being made around the wrong questions. We are at a point where we're still struggling to overcome the deepest, most entrenched recession that this nation has seen since our Great Depression. Still, we are surrounded by discussions that almost exclusively focus on the issue of the deficit. The issue really is making sure that people not only work, but get good quality jobs, jobs that will create the level of wages that are necessary in order to fuel this economy. That's the way out of this recession. Instead, we continue to be driven around this issue of deficit reduction, which continues to be put in such a way that the main argument that is on the table is one of austerity, even though we know factually, not only from history, but also from what's going on right now in Europe, that austerity doesn't work. And so the answer, just as we've just heard, is making sure that the individual at the grassroots level is able to mobilize and raise their voices in such a way to bring the discussion back to the issue of their specific pocketbooks. And we really have to do that in a way that brings people together rather than divides people, which unfortunately has been the modus operandi to get us distracted onto this question of not only deficit reduction, but being jealous of, frankly, this issue of individuals who have something that I feel they don't deserve. It's this division between, once again, the deserving and the undeserving poor, which oftentimes is really reduced down to, frankly, racial divisions among us.
So who is poor? What's the contextual reality of that? And let's start again with Peter.
Poorest age group in our country are children. That's been true, actually, for about 40 years. It used to be the elderly, but we have a great public policy success for the elderly, not only Social Security, but in the 1970s it was indexed to inflation, and we had enacted supplemental security insurance, and of course Medicare didn't hurt either. Meantime, what happened is that we started to become and are now a low-wage nation. Half the jobs in the country pay less than $34,000 a year, and that's if you have the job full-time and all year. And when you have only one wage earner, when that's usually a woman, a mom, then it's just very, very hard to get out of poverty and to get on up to the point of having a wage you can live on. So women are overwhelmingly the people who are by themselves in the labor market with very low-wage jobs. And secondly, talked about the 6 million people who have only food stamps and no other income. Well, that's significantly because we knocked a huge hole in the safety net by essentially taking welfare, now temporary assistance to needy families, driving it largely out of existence. Half the states, less than 20% of poor kids get assistance in their family. And again, that's about mothers and children. That's a gender issue. And the other answer, of course, is race, because African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans are all poor at a rate of about 27% now. It's almost three times the rate among whites. So race and gender are very much the characteristics. And our politics goes along the same lines. So whether you want to start with Ronald Reagan and the woman who comes to the grocery store in her white Cadillac, et cetera, to buy the best cut of meat, everybody understood that was an African-American woman. Through Willie Horton in the first Bush campaign, race is very, very much in our politics about poverty.
Frances, do you want to pick up on that?
Well, yes, I, of course, agree with Peter. But we have to address the question of the kind of politics that could reverse the policies that have contributed mightily to these trends. And we can get some sort of sense of the politics that we have to fight against by paying attention to the 2012 presidential and congressional campaign that's now going on. We have been through a period when the income of not just poor people, but working people has declined, when they have become much more insecure, when because of high unemployment they are willing to take minimum wage jobs. At the same time, the richest people have become richer and richer and richer and glorify in their rhetoric the greed that has led to this soaring inequality. The 99%, as Occupy rightly said, are doing worse. Well, how has that been possible? Just pay attention to the campaign so far. The 1%, represented now by the Republican Party, but also by the Democratic Party, the 1% need votes. How are they talking to people? They are emphasizing the issues having to do with race. I mean, what does it mean when they fish out of entirely make-believe interpretation of Obama's policies that he is promoting welfare at the expense of Medicare? I mean, that's a race issue, because Medicare recipients are white and welfare recipients, when we had them, when we gave welfare to people, are disproportionately African American and Latino. Or the campaign issues are sexual issues having to do with abortion and family. We have a big propaganda problem, and you can see it right now in the election campaign. The only hope we have is the hope of a convulsive, tumultuous movement from poor and working people that explodes this propaganda. That's the way it's always been, because the rich have always had the ability to try to twist our minds, and only when people start moving together, recognizing the reality of their circumstances and their natural solidarities, does American politics sometimes change. Can it change now? Well, there's no answer to that question, but there's no alternative to massive protest, I think, to turn around the direction of this country.
Avis, is there any other way of getting poverty on the agenda except a mass movement?
I really don't see an alternative. It's as if poverty is a dirty word. And I would say that that is the case, frankly, with both parties. You do not hear the word poverty. You hear middle class, which also, frankly, getting the short end of the stick in terms of the policy prescriptions that are often prescribed indefinitely, the austerity directions that are being pushed by some of those, particularly those on the right. It's as if poverty is synonymous with a plague of some sort that shall not be mentioned. I just go back to this concept, tied around this notion of the mythical idea of the American dream, that it is in this nation one achieves based on a fair meritocracy, that if you have the ability, if you have the intelligence and the personal ambition, you can make it. Now, if you fully buy into that argument and don't even acknowledge the institutional barriers that are put in place, then it then stands to reason that those individuals who are poor must be poor for a reason, right? It then becomes logical that those who are poor because of some sort of personal deficits that they have. They are then the opposite of all of those qualities I just mentioned. They are lazy. They are not intelligent. They do not have ambition. They are just there to take the spoils of what others have earned as a result of their hard work. So it has, once again, created the situation where the poor are seen as deserving poor. And when Peter was talking about this issue of gender as being just as important, at least, as race, and talking about poverty, he was dead on. And if you look at, for example, the black woman's experience, African-American women, along with Native American women, are the demographic groups that are most likely to be poor in this country. When you look at the black woman's experience as it relates to poverty, because we have the highest labor force participation rate of women in this country. So we're not poor because we're not working. We're poor because we get paid extremely low wages. Yet the perception is that this sort of welfare queen mythology, the image that people have in their mind of poverty in America, is typically that of a black woman who is undeserving, who is not working, who has 5 different children by 10 different fathers, you know, if that is indeed mathematically possible. So we have really been sold a bill of goods. What we really need to have people understand is that when we're talking about working people in this country who are making typically only around $30,000 or so an annual income, they see themselves, though, as middle-class, hardworking, working people. We have to find a way to form alliances with that group of people and with all of those who are sort of struggling to make ends meet, because even if you're making a lot more than $30,000, I would argue that in most cities in this country, you can make a whole lot more than $35,000 a year and still be struggling. So we really need to understand how we can form a movement that is multiracial in nature, that includes obviously both genders, that includes people across that full 99% that needs to understand how we're all in this together, not getting our needs even examined in a very serious way in terms of a lot of the policy discussions, and think about ways that we can protect the advancements that we've had, but actually push the conversations even further in the direction that we need to go. I think those people who determine what, in fact, the discussion is, you know, has almost already won the discussion. We need to change the paradigm and say, really, the issue in this nation is that we need to make sure that people not only have jobs, but they have jobs that pay fair wages, they have jobs that allow them to live lives of dignity. Those are the sorts of discussions that we really need to have. And in doing that, we would create an economy that is driven by individuals who have then enough money to be able to spend the money that is necessary to live a decent quality of life. That is how we need to frame this discussion around how we can bring this economy back, rather than having different squabbles about what we should cut instead of where we should invest.
One of the things that I'm seeing is a new grouping of people who are seeking services from the Legal Aid Society. For example, there were people who had really pulled themselves out of poverty. They were the last hired and the first fired. They were women. They were people of color almost exclusively. And they have now been laid off. They have lost their jobs. And suddenly these folks are being pushed down into destitution as they've exhausted their unemployment benefits. And the contempt that is there is absolutely palpable. What's going on with the consciousness that the working poor, the people who are being laid off, are dealt with contemptuously? Or indeed, why is there no real mass movement for wealth distribution? Peter, why don't we start with you again?
It's been disappointing to me, Amy, when you talk about people who were more recently laid off and how they've been treated. It's also true that I expected that the politics about low-income people would change in this recession, and that the new poor, people who've joined the ranks of those who were having such a tough time but only recently, would make common cause with people who'd been poor or near poor for a while. Didn't happen. people put themselves into a position where they want to be have somebody who's below them, who's worse off than they are, that they can look down on. So
maybe you're too impatient,
that
Peter.
I was hoping over the course of the last 4 years didn't emerge in terms
no,
of the broader...
But give it time.
For that,
let me say one other thing. There are protests emerging.
Just very quickly, because I want to hear from you. But one thing we have going for us is that it's always been true with all the disproportionate poverty of people of color. There are more whites who are poor, and there should be a politics in that.
There have been protests emerging. Occupy is not gone. Movements stutter and sputter, and people try different things. Occupy had a very good slogan, still a slogan. Everybody's using it. We are the 99%. And they are the 1%. Protests are still current. Occupy allied with labor unions, including unions of pretty low-wage workers. Protests against foreclosures, a new animus toward the banks. We may now be seeing a kind of resistance movement.
And I have to say that I'm less optimistic because our problem is that we have an individualist culture. That is really at the root of why we don't see this unification after what would have been logical. We also have a historical precedent for this. You look back into really the roots of this nation in terms of our slave experience. Overseers were poor whites. And so there was this division there that was implanted from the very beginning. It is not unusual that we are seeing what we're seeing here, not only among the new poor, but with regard to the vast majority, frankly, of poor whites that we have in this country. So for many years, political scientists have wondered, then why is it? Do you have so many poor whites voting against their own economic interests? Oftentimes, they end up doing that as a result of very, very sophisticated political campaigns, not unlike what we're seeing right now, that oftentimes use racially coded language to get individuals who would not benefit from certain economic programs to still play on the animus that they have and the stereotypes that they have about other groups and to vote to align themselves with what they see as something that they aspire to. If those other people don't get off my back, or if what I earn isn't in some way reduced by having to give some of it to somebody else, we have a much deeper cultural individualistic nature as a nation, and that is not divorced from our racial context and racial history, that we really have to examine if we really want to move forward in a class-conscious way versus a way that, frankly, is stratified right now across all three, race, class, and gender.
Peter, we've been talking about this for a while in more general terms, but let's get into some specifics as how to not only stimulate the economy, but to put out some policy issues out that would capture people's imaginations and that we can rally around.
It's hard to say specifics that would send people to the barricade. The basis that Francis was talking about in terms of movement is painting with a broader brush, as Occupy did, about the 1% and the 90%, which was very evocative. I agree with Frances. She may be a little more optimistic than I am, but I absolutely agree that the ingredients for a movement are there in terms of the more progressive unions and some of the more progressive-based people, groups that are based in race, Avis, and gender, and so on. If we sound to the listeners like we're, except for Francis, not so optimistic, we've done a lot. There would be 40 million more people in poverty right now if we hadn't enacted Social Security and food stamps and earned income tax credit, a lot of other things. We'd have almost twice as many people in poverty. So it isn't as though we've been unable to do things. And many of those things were done after the 60s, were done when Nixon was president, and on through some of them, despite the welfare thing that we disagree with so much, things that Clinton did, the earned income tax credit. And really, the challenge is about building a broader movement and cutting across racial lines and to a degree across income lines, too, so that we reach those people who are struggling, who were between poverty and twice the level of poverty. That's the 103 million.
I don't think that the solutions to problems that people are experiencing in the United States are going to be easy. It's not something that we will achieve, say, winning the next election, although I think we we should try to win the next election because the alternative is so grim. The power from below that Avis talked about, it's hard to mobilize, but more importantly, it is a power that requires, demands, the disruption of much about American life and American economic and political institutions. That's the way poor people and working people sometimes exercise some leverage. It's a matter of being willing to support the people who are defiant, who break rules, who take risks. That's what a movement is. A movement is not just talk.
I agree that it is not anything that will be a beeline forward. This is a type of change that will be two steps forward, one step back. It's definitely not a simplistic manner. However, I do agree that it is the only way forward. The conundrum, though, is figuring out how to inspire that. It was very inspiring to see the 99% movement organically bubble up. It was wonderful to see that take form. And I would love to see some sort of resurgence in that, in a mass replication with particular and specific policy demands moving forward. A question was asked about what would be an example of some particular policy that people could rally around. There's a whole bunch of them. One of the things that immediately comes to my mind is this issue of dealing with the continued repercussions of the housing crisis. Whether
Absolutely.
Or not you are an individual who has lost your home as a result of foreclosure, who has lost equity in your home because of the upside-down nature of the market right now, that is a way that we can thread the needle across a variety of different individuals at a number of different levels and really make a very persuasive argument about how this, number one, wasn't your fault. Number two, this is a problem that has only been rectified for the wealthiest among us. It's very interesting that in first, frankly, saving the banks, at the end of the day, only the wealth of the wealthy was reimbursed, right? The wealth of everyone else has just lost. There has been some legal action that has taken place that's led to a little bit of a settlement for individuals, but it's nowhere near the amount of funds that was provided for the individuals, frankly, that caused the crisis, who, for the most part, have yet to face any sort of legal repercussions. That is one area where, if pushed and primed properly, it is possible to unify people.
I agree with Avis. I think that housing is one possible arena of mass action. I also think that the banks are vulnerable because they're morally so culpable. You could join that with student actions because student debt, students are not allowed to claim bankruptcy protection, and student debt has been rising, and students pay all this money, borrow money, and they get out of school and they don't have a job. And that could be a sort of collateral movement with a movement holding on to the homes that people pay for over long periods of time, scraping their pennies together. What they have in common also is the targeting of the financial sector and the uses of debt to squeeze ordinary Americans.
Peter, do you want to bounce off that and especially talk about...
Yes, well, I agree with both of those suggestions. Housing is a terrible problem, and we really have not responded. I've been very disappointed as well, and Francis, I think you're right about student debt. We're at a point now that we really ought to be raising the minimum wage. It's not as sort of topical as the housing and the student debt, but there are ballot measures in a number of states to raise the minimum wage, and those should be enacted. We're way, way behind at $7.25 an hour, what the historical highs have been in the minimum wage. It really should be about $10 an hour. That doesn't take us to everything we need to do. It's just one important thing. The thing I would add here to this, we have to defend what we have right now. That's the immediate task. The American people need to be much clearer than they are about who Paul Ryan is and what he stands for and what his budget proposes to do. I mean, he had the nerve to say in his speech at the Republican convention that he wanted to protect the safety net when he is the major attacker of the safety net. and wants to turn Medicare into vouchers and Medicaid and food stamps into block grants where there would be no minimum standards at all and states could help anybody they wanted, hurt anybody they wanted, and on through a whole long list of things. What we need to do is get truth into the campaign here, understand what's being proposed by the Republican Party here in a way that is going to be disastrous for not only low-income people, but working people, people on up into the middle, and it contains more giveaways to the rich and the people at the top. That's the number one task right now, is to stop the lying and defend the policies that we have that have been successful in helping people at least have a better income based mainly on working and also as a safety net.
I agree with everything that Peter said, but the question is, how do we override lies and propaganda? What are our ways of getting our truths into the public domain? And that's one of the reasons movements are so important. We don't have the propaganda machine that they have. We don't have the super PACs that they have. And even the Democratic Party is a weak and muddled voice in answering those lies. Yeah, I agree. It would be a disaster if Romney-Ryan ticket were to triumph and if the Republicans were to take the Senate as well as the House. We don't have a message machine. We don't have the money. We have only the protest movement. That's our weapon in fighting what is a class war.
The might of the people and mass movements certainly are what is responsible for changing history. And we really appreciate the contributions of all three of you. I would encourage people to read So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America by Professor Peter Edelman and Francis Fox Piven's book, which the title alone should encourage you to do it. Who's Afraid of Francis Fox Piven? The Essential Writings of the Professor Glenn Beck Loves to Hate, and we can certainly understand why and why we love to love her. And we want to thank Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver for all of the contributions. And as we opened up by saying, there are many who look at you on the intersection of race and gender, fighting for justice every step of the way as an agent for change onto yourself. Thank you all for joining us, and many struggles to come, and I know you're all going to be on the front lines.
Better believe it.
Thanks for the great discussion.
Thank you.
You all are on the front lines. Thank you so much for being there.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.